Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at DennisJBernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
And this program has been made possible in part by KBOO members and support from Artemis Foods, Portland's local organic and sustainable catering company since 2000. Special events, corporate and wedding catering with seasonal menus and service supported by sustainable business operations. Artemis offers full service and drop-off catering. Info at artemisfoods.com. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up in a half hour at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, today with a look at virtual reality and 3D comics. Hear how the immersive technology is transforming the world of animation and comics. But up next at 11, we've got Between the Covers. Your host, David Naiman, will be welcoming Yuri Hereda, talking about his novel, Kingdom Cons. That is coming up next on The Boo. And thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag FuzzyBoo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have FuzzyBoo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/FuzzyBoo.
This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market. From our hands to yours, celebrating 44 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is Mexican novelist Yuri Hereda. Hereda's first novel published in English, The Signs Preceding the End of the World, published by And Other Stories and translated by Lisa Dillman, was called a 100-page literary detonation by critic Aaron Beatty, finding itself on many end-of-the-year best-of lists and winning the 2016 Best Translated Book Award, beating out the likes of Elena Ferrante and Carl Ove Knausgård. Yuri Hereda studied political science in Mexico, creative writing in El Paso, Texas, and completed a doctorate in literature at the University of California, Berkeley. He currently resides in New Orleans, where he teaches at Tulane University. And Hereda's second translated novel, The Transmigration of Bodies, was also published by And Other Stories and translated by Lisa Dillman, and continued to establish Yuri's stature in the English-speaking world of literature. I say English-speaking because he was already a highly regarded figure in the Spanish-speaking world prior to these translations. Francisco Goldman calls Yuri Hereda Mexico's greatest novelist, saying that his spare poetic narratives in incomparable prose read like epics compacted into a single perfect punch. They ring your bell, your being, your soul. Daniel Alarcón calls Yuri Hereda the writer of his generation he most admires. And Valeria Luiselli says, Yuri Hereda must be 1,000 years old. He must have traveled to hell and heaven and back again. He must have once been a girl, an animal, a rock, a boy, and a woman. Nothing else explains the vastness of his understanding. Yuri Hereda is here today to talk about his third book in English, Kingdom Cons, a book that both stands alone and completes a loose thematic trilogy with the two that precede it. The Spanish version of Kingdom Cons, Trabajos del Reino, won both the Border of Words U.S.-Mexico Cross-Border Novel Prize and the Otras Focas, Otros Ámbitos Award for Best Novel published in Spain that year. Publishers Weekly says of Kingdom Cons, the relationship between art and violence is at the core of Hereda's slim yet powerful novel about the various members of a drug trafficking ring in an unnamed territory allegorically aligned with northern Mexico. The novel is a powerful and memorable meditation on the social and economic value of art in a world ruled by the pursuit of power. Welcome to Between the Covers, Yuri Hereda.
Thank you for seeing me, David.
So all three of your books have protagonists who are intermediaries and interpreters, in a sense, people who have whatever influence they have somehow through language. So when we look at your first book in English Signs, Makina is both a switchboard operator and a crosser of borders. So she's a deliverer of messages in two ways. And in your second translated book, Transmigration, the Redeemer is a fixer who also is sort of an interpreter and negotiator between two warring families. And here we also have in Kingdom Khan's Lobo, who's also an intermediary and an interpreter in a sense. And all three are found in this situation of having to deal with this question of how to remain true when it may not be true to themselves and authentic to themselves when it may not actually be entirely possible to do so. But what makes this book stand out a little bit is that Lobo is the first protagonist you have who is also an artist and a writer himself. So he's called the artist later in the book. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Lobo, the ways he uses his art and the way he's used with his art in Kingdom Khan's.
Yes. Well, this thing about that my protagonist being links or being bridges or being in between different situations and different identities, different groups, it's something that I discovered afterwards. It wasn't part of an agenda. It wasn't part of a plan. You know, you start discovering your obsessions as you elaborate them, you know. And I don't know, it might have to do with the fact that I have lived in three countries in eight different cities, and you always have to create a new way to communicate with the city, with the streets where you are, with your neighbors. And also from coming from Mexico, a place that since I was born needs a lot more communication or better communication, you know. That's only a small part of our many problems, but it's an important part of it. In this book, what we have there is a really young man that has survived singing, writing songs and singing in the cantina, singing on the streets. So it has been for him just a survival skill. One day he meets this really powerful guy. At that moment, he doesn't know exactly why he is so powerful, but he can feel his power. He can feel that he has influence, that he has command over other people's lives. And after a bloody scene, which is the opening scene of the novel, this person calls him artist. And this is what triggers the rest of the story, because he didn't, up to that point, he didn't see himself as an artist. He just saw himself as a survivor. And he understands from that moment on that what he does is important for other people, and that is important in a general sense, that it is not just about finding a way to earn your living, but it's also a way of creating beauty and a way of telling the truth. And this last part, the creating the truth, the discovering the truth, is what will lead us to a conflict between these two protagonists. Hmm.
Can you explain to our listeners who may not be familiar with it about the form, the corrido, and also potentially the narco corrido in contemporary music? Because I think some listeners will know what this form is, and others might have never heard of it before.
Yeah. Well, the corrido is like the hair of a very old forms song form that comes from Spain, from medieval Spain, where you would have these singers that would tell stories from town to town. And the interesting thing about these singers is that they would play for both the aristocrats and for the people. And maybe supposedly. Sometimes they would change a little bit what they were singing, but it was basically the same story. So they became this sort of, I wouldn't say newspaper, but they were like these agents of information that created a sense of community of sorts. So this form came to Mexico, came to the colonies, and survived there. And in the 19th century, it became really important in Mexico when it became a way of talking about, now maybe we would say countercultural people, bandits and people fighting the government. And from that moment on, the corrido became a privileged way of speaking about people confronting power. You know, so during the revolution between 1917 or 1920, more or less, the corrido registered a lot of the deeds of the revolutionaries, of Pancho Villa, Emiliano Zapata, Felipe Ángeles, and curiously enough, and in a very important way, the corridos also talk about the revolutionary women in Mexico, which were really important. We don't talk enough about that, but there are a lot of women participated in the revolution, not only as companions of the revolutionary men, but actually fighting. Afterwards, the corrido started in Mexico, started talking about social issues, and maybe in the 60s and 70s, started speaking about the drug issue, and particularly about this craziness that is the war on drugs. This started then, but since the 80s and especially since the 90s, it became pretty much an industry. Now the narco corridos are not only songs that praise drug traffickers. Sometimes they praise one, sometimes they criticize them, sometimes they talk about the victims, sometimes they talk about the addicts, sometimes they talk about the government. So it's a really interesting genre that is widely popular in Mexico, and I would say in the United States as well.
Mm. And in this case, Lobo, who becomes the artist, who's renamed the artist by the character named the King, is writing songs to glamorize the successes of the King within his world.
At the beginning. That's the whole thing. But he's not doing it because he's being paid. He's doing it because he's convinced about it. Because he's convinced that this person really is doing something important for the community the way he's doing it for him. But as he realizes his own importance and his own power through words and music, then it's when it becomes complicated.
Mm-hmm. So, as I mentioned at the beginning, these novels are all standalone. They have their own distinct set of characters, their own distinct locations, but they do seem to share an aesthetic sensibility in some regards. And one of them is that they all three seem to have an intentional lack of specificity, where we intuit where we are in the contemporary world. And there are things that signal towards certain places or themes, but we aren't placed in a very specific geographic location. There's some sort of like movement happening between a location we can that gets suggested and maybe something that's more archetypal. And in this case, what seems really interesting in Kingdom Cons is we have the King, and the King and the corrido, it harkens to perhaps a drug cartel and perhaps to Mexico, but it also has a feeling like we're in a European court of a different era at the same time. And I'm wondering if you could talk about what you're going for and what that doubling of place and time is doing in the book.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I like to do is just to work with the reader in the sense that every single book is finished in the reader's mind. You might put the final period of your book, but the book is not finished there because the book changes its meaning, it changes its sense with every single reader. And I like to play with that, and I like to play with that not abusing certain words and certain names and certain names of places that somehow sometimes are like pre-digested words that do the job for you, you know. So if you, for instance, in this novel in Kingdom Comes, I never use the word drugs, I never use the word border, I never use the word drug trafficking, because these words are like code words that when you read them, you think that you already know what it's talking about. And I think the richness of literature is that it's power of estrangement, that you have to understand what is going on there beyond these code words. So that's why I don't rely on certain words, on certain names of places. And also because what I try to do is to tell stories that are not circumscribed to just one time or just one town, but that can be seen as stories that are trying to reflect on human issues, on human conflicts that go beyond these specific towns. Now, with this, as you said, it has the air of a European court, because I had been thinking about that for a while. You know, that is the way we see artists interacted with kings in European courts has been established sort of as an archetype of a certain relationship between artists and powerful people. And this is an issue that had always been of interest to me. How did Velázquez and Bach and Mozart and all these people were able to keep being interesting, original, free in a way, while at the same time working for these people that very often were brats, were toddlers, you know?
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the things that art allows you to do, to make some deltas, to find unsuspected ways of telling the truth. And this is something that has happened not only in the European courts and not only in the Mexican cities where you have these people that had crazy with power, but it happens in democracies. You know, when you have a president that loves to have his name in golden letters in big buildings, that's exactly the same kind of craziness and the same kind of cheap way of looking at your position in the world that drug lords and toddler kings had in Europe. So this is a universal problem, and it's one that I decided to approach from the landscape in which I was living. When I wrote this, I was living in the border between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez, and I decided to make it organically to talk about that landscape, to talk about that kind of characters with that border language, you know.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to writer Yuri Herrera about his latest book, Kingdom Comes. It's interesting that you mentioned Mozart and Velázquez, because I wonder too, like, one of the questions of this book is, as being an artist who has a patron, how do you stay true to your art while also, when you have a reliance on someone who's sort of funding you, and it makes me wonder, like, would Mozart have written so much church music, or would these painters have made portraits of so many aristocratic children if they had full freedom to do whatever they wanted, if they weren't reliant on these powers? But on the same time, like, the great artists seem to be able to both do that and transcend the limitations of the fact that they're maybe what they're writing about or painting changes because of the relationship to the patron, but somehow they're also finding a way to resist it.
Yes, you have to work with the cards that have been dealt to you. And we have been talking about the patrons as politicians or state figures, but patrons come in very different ways, you know. It sometimes are like these huge companies that monopolize the distribution of books, or it can be universities because universities are places that are meant to discipline thought, to discipline creation. So I think that the key is how you work with that without betraying yourself, without becoming just a servant to these patrons. No? Mm.
You've talked before about how borders, you believe borders are not actually distinct geographic places, that they're not simply a line between countries, but that places far away from the physical border can still be living under what you call a border condition or a border situation. So a good example would be the second novel in the English translation of this trilogy, The Transmigration of Bodies, which takes place in the interior of Mexico, but could be considered to be within a border condition, essentially. And Kingdom Cons takes place on a different sort of border, it seems like, in the sense that we're dealing with both a literal border, but we're also dealing with this interplay between Europe and the past, and maybe the colonial past, with and contemporary America and Mexico. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit just about your sensibility around borders. I know you're not using the word border in the book, yeah, but could you talk a little bit about border conditions, yeah, in terms of your novels?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I am aware that borders are very concrete physical places, and every person that has tried or has to cross, or that has crossed, has seen all the walls and the barbed wire and the dogs and all the chauvinistic crazy people chasing people trying to find a job. But what I'm saying is that some things that for good and bad that happen around the borders happen in many other places far away from the actual political physical borders. And with this, I mean different things. One is every place where you have different communities exchanging values, exchanging goods, exchanging perspectives on the world, there is a sort of border condition, because you are, both communities are in some sense challenging the stability and the identity of that place. That place is changing just by the existence of them. And places where we find this border condition are laboratories of linguistic forms or political practices of identities. So these places, the places that receive migrants, the places that receive refugees, are places that, in my mind, are some of the most interesting and richest places that you can find. But also there is a dark side of the border condition, which is that you don't need to be, and we are witnessing this right now in this country in a very dramatic way, you don't need to be in the border to be chased by an immigration officer. Some in many places, what you have is normal citizens that they just assume that they have to become sort of informants for the police, and they start just denouncing workers just because in their eyes they don't deserve to be doing what they do. So this is running away from the barbed wire is something that happens not only where we find the barbed wire. Happens, it may happen in many other places, you know.
And it's interesting about what you were saying before about removing certain words, like you don't say the United States and you don't say Mexico, and you don't say border and you don't say immigration. It allows the story also to ring true about other migrations and other borders. So I think there's a resonance with, say, what's going on in Syria or what's going on in Central America, even though we know that we're not in Syria in the book.
Yeah, of course. I think migrations is one of the most important things. Massive migrations, in the way that they are happening at the same time right now, is one of the most important phenomena of our times. They are transforming national states and languages and the rules by which we understand travel. And even if we don't pay attention to them, they are doing this. And, well, there's a lot of information about Syria, maybe not enough, but certainly there's not enough information about what is happening with the Central American migrants when they are crossing Mexico and when they are entering the United States. And I keep saying this, the Central American migrants are suffering a tragedy of biblical proportions, hundreds of thousands of people being harassed, kidnapped, tortured, and all because most of them want to get a job. I would recommend them, among many other things, the book by Oscar Martinez, The Beast, which in Spanish is called Los Migrantes Que No Importan, which is an investigation about all the things that they have to endure, the Central American migrants, when they cross Mexico to the United States.
When you talk about borders and border conditions existing far from the borders, and about a migrating across borders of both place and time, it reminds me of a quote you cited before that I think could be used to describe certain aspects about all three of your books as a border trilogy. And that is that what most people consider the problems of Mexico should really be considered not Mexico's problems, but the American problem that Mexico is suffering from. Can you talk a little bit about the American problem that Mexico is suffering from in relationship to this idea of border conditions?
Well, in this, that quote specifically is about the whole violence generated by the war on drugs. The first thing that I would have to say is that I don't try to deny our own responsibility, as citizens, our own responsibility regarding our inept and corrupt politicians, our own responsibility regarding the violence and of our criminal organizations and our police. But what I try to stress is this, that this business is supported by a certain conditions imposed from the United States. Most of the money comes from the United States. Most of the weapons comes from the United States. Most of the demand comes from the United States. And the whole rules of the business, which means that how you make certain drugs forbidden, and how it becomes more expensive, and how getting them becomes more dangerous, they were established in the United States. So this is something that was not created in Mexico. And there, we can talk about this for a long time, but I would have to say just one piece of information. For instance, pot has been grown in Mexico for a long, long time. It started being grown in an industrial way during the Second World War, because some of its components were used for the American Army to help in the creation of uniforms and in the production of uniforms and other stuff. So the whole drug industry in Mexico is linked to the needs of the United States, to the needs of the American Army, to the needs of the American economy, and to the needs of the American consumers. And I have to repeat, this is not to say that we don't have responsible. We are responsible of a lot of things, of just obeying the stupid Nixon and Reagan rules regarding this, of not consolidating our democracy and clear, efficient institution, among other things. But we have to be clear that these industrial tragedies are not national phenomenons. They respond to international business, you know. So this is one of the things that we have to repeat and repeat. These things are not constrained within certain borders, but they respond to the way money flows around the world.
Well, if we return to the predicament of our protagonist, Lobo, who's later called the artist by the king, who begins by writing songs out of a desire, out of a true feeling towards the king and the things that he's accomplishing, but it becomes more complicated later in the story. I think of the Spanish title of the book, Trabajos del Reino, which perhaps can be translated as the works of the kingdom, if mm-hmm. you're doing it literally. And I wondered if the works of the kingdom suggested that the works of a kingdom are that of making and telling and selling stories, that stories are both the makers of kingdoms and the way that kingdoms are brought down.
Of course, it's part of that. I mean, the title alludes to the loss of individuality by the people that work in this space. Because when they are working for this guy, their personal concerns, their personal talents are only there to serve the the king. So in his case, yeah, he is an artist because that king decided that he's an artist. He eventually would discover that he is an artist not because of him, but because of his work. But this is something that is repeated. This is something that happens with all the other characters, that they are what they are because there is someone giving them that stature or that title. And this happens in a very dramatic way also with the women in this novel, because the women are there in subservient roles, and they had to find a way to survive and to thrive in a world with rules made by men, and eventually they have to resist and maybe escape this world, you know? Hmm.
You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host, and we've been talking today to Yuri Herrera about his latest book, Kingdom Cons. If you enjoyed today's conversation, there's actually another 45 minutes of this conversation. You will be able to find it later today at our website at kboo.fm/betweenthecovers.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee is the third Thursday of each month at 5 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, and welcome to Words and Pictures, the show all about